Mini episode 1939 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1939. You have with you here today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Ben Chu. Ben, of course, our FDH hoops analyst, here to talk a review of the summer of 2026 for the NBA, Summer League, and the trades and transactions that have happened in the free agency period. I'm sure we'll take a little bit of a look back to the draft as well. And Ben, I would say that for as much as we've been moving through essentially the 20th century as far as show numbers here, seeing if any of them correlate to anything that we're talking about, there might be some that might consider LeBron signing with Philadelphia the September 1st, 1939 for the rest of the NBA. I'm not sure that I'm one of those people.
I have no comment.
I don't consider it to be the equivalent myself, but that's obviously the headliner, and that's one of the things that is most recent here as we are talking. It is one of, I don't know if people would say, I actually don't think it's the biggest thing. I don't think it's bigger than the Jaylen Brown trade, because the Jaylen Brown trade is second only to the Luka trade in the recent history of the NBA as far as historic head scratchers. But the combination of those two things together in Philadelphia, it's very interesting when you look at the makeup of the team here. They're going to run about seven deep, essentially, in terms of they did get Simons in the trade from Boston. He's going to be helpful. You've got good old Dean Wade coming over with Mike Gansey. But looking at it here, like for the times when Embiid is not playing at center, and there's no way this guy's playing 82 games, even if he is healthy, because they're going to rest him a whole bunch of times here. Going to be very, very interesting to see, does Dean Wade sneak in some time at center here? And as far as LeBron goes, the guy that it was said when he came into the league, more Magic than Michael. Well, Magic famously in his first year in the NBA in the finals played center against Philly. Does LeBron end up playing some center for Philly as they go to some smaller lineups out of necessity? A lot of questions there. I mean, I would slot them in as the favorites in the East right now, but there are legitimate questions vis-a-vis as far as the usage rates of all of these guys. You've got Jaylen Brown, who famously said that his favorite season was not the championship season in Boston, but the one where he got the shine in the absence of Jason Tatum. So what does that look like? How does Embiid fit with a lot of these guys? And RIP, pour one out for the Fantasy League keeper owners of VJ Edgecombe. That guy just lost a lot of value over the course of the next 2 years or so, because he's going to be the fifth mouth to get served out of these five, when in fact he may already be potentially the third best player out of them, which is interesting. So there's a lot to unpack here. The fit that there's going to be with the pieces here. And by the way, and that's to say nothing of the issues that Jaylen Brown has had in the past with Embiid and with LeBron, and I think LeBron with Embiid a little bit here. I'm assuming that that part's going to be put away as they deal with this. But as far as the on-court, how it's going to go, I certainly don't think it's going to be seamless, but I do have them as the early favorites in the East. How do you see it?
Sure, and I feel like that's pretty correct at this period of time. Again, obviously, usage rate is big. You have four players. Like, Edgecombe had a high usage rate last year, but that was just for necessity was a mother of invention at that period of time. So,
sure,
it's going to be really interesting, especially since Embiid is one of those players that really needs the ball. And there was discussions at periods of time earlier that some scouts viewed him as a ball stopper, even though he was an amazing player during his MVP run. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, they're going to have to look at their bench. I did see there's rumors that Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is going to get bought out from the Memphis Grizzlies, and he's going to join them. Okay. They have a handful of other decently undersized bigs in Dominic Barlow and Adama Bona. But again, they're very similar to the Miami Heat at this time. They're going to be very thin on the bench, and especially since we've been harping for the last, oh, 2 or 3 years of depth is going to be very important once you get to the playoffs. And we saw that with the Knicks this year, we're getting a lot of positive run from guys like Landry Shamet and Mitchell Robinson and getting key rebounds late in the Eastern Conference Finals and then the NBA Finals. Depth is still going to be a major thing. But again, logically, it makes sense for LeBron to go to a team that will be able to compete for a championship and to get out of the Western Conference, which we know is, at this time, it's a little bit more balanced than we've seen in recent memory, Rick. But the West is still going to be a buzzsaw at the end of the day.
It is going to be. And out of the guys that you mentioned, Bona looks to be the guy that's going to get probably the most use at center here, especially when Embiid is out. He might be the default guy. And this is a thing where a lot of times with these super teams that get assembled, it is a notion where you see them on the court together, beginning of the game and the end of the game and the beginning of the second half and the end of the first half. And I really think with Philadelphia, potentially even in the playoffs, that might be the case of where you're seeing the five of them together there. And again, when they're all healthy anyways, I'm thinking in limited bursts because, again, and even though the rest of the bench, obviously if they get KCP, then they can legitimately be running eight deep as far as guys that they can be comfortable with. And that's a little bit better anyways. But I just think, again, you have so many high usage guys there. I'd heard an interview where LeBron was talking about, I'm not really not used to being the third option in L.A. And it's just like, and then there was a guy on the radio that was saying, well, he's going to be the third option there sometimes. And I'm like, he might be the fourth option there sometimes. Yeah. I mean, like when Embiid's healthy, he might be the fourth. Like, obviously, and I was joking about this about with Edgecombe before, but simply as a matter of seniority, he's the last of the five. I'd argue he may already be the third best of the five. I think that's arguable, but the politics of it, he's going to get the least amount of consideration. But if Embiid is healthy, and you said he's a very high usage player, and you've got Brown arguably ahead of him and Maxey, who I think is the best of the players at this moment in time, it's going to be a very, very interesting fit. And I think, again, you may see a lot of staggering of Maxey and LeBron on the court at the same time so that LeBron can be the primary facilitator in the absence of Maxey. Sometimes out there. So the staggering of how you see the parts out there, you know, maybe two big stars at a time, maybe three, and then a couple other guys where you're kind of holding your breath potentially. You may be seeing an awful lot of that. And I think there's going to be a lot of guys in Philly, especially early on, getting auditions for the rest of the rotation. So that part of it is going to be fascinating.
Sure. And I think too, Rick, one of the benefits for Philly is that a lot of these guys, Barlow, Watford, Jabari Walker, Bona, because of injuries last season, all had to play meaningful minutes in a rotation. So they're not exactly, I would say, in comparison to the Heat, devoid of talent on the back end. It's just a lot of unproven talent at this period of time, or guys who have essentially been up and down during their NBA careers.
Yeah. And that's where, again, they're going to get a chance to show their stuff here. And that could be a very interesting reality show early on in the season, is if you did something where you were following around the guys who were fighting for the last two rotation spots. But, you know, you mentioned Miami also, one of the potential suitors there for LeBron. And I had the pleasure of subbing a week ago on the Callis Remarks podcast as Steve Callis was off taking a very well-deserved vacation. So being on there with Joe Stazak and breaking down the LeBron sweepstakes a little bit and talking about Miami, and I said, as far as it goes on the technical side of things here, and again, everybody made the assumption that, oh, they got the Greek Freak there, that makes them a player, and then I guess like the past history and Spoelstra and Riley and whatever. But I said at the time, I said, on a technical level, what's one of the things LeBron values the most? Floor spacing. You right. got Giannis and you got Bam. Tyler Hero doesn't live here anymore. Duncan Robinson doesn't live here anymore. So that's a thing where he looked at that, I'm sure, and said, that is not going to work in the modern NBA trying to put these pieces together. And again, I sort of question, them putting all their chips on Giannis being there, as far as, again, the fact that they're not really able to surround him with much in the way of shooting. And I really think that in the case, unless some of these guys really pan out for Milwaukee and or the opportunities end up helping guys to elevate their games to another level in Milwaukee, like Tyler Hero, and unless Brandon Burries and, you know, possibly Nate Amendt also can really get things going, to me that might be the example of a trade that hurts both teams, because Miami had to give up just about all of their depth, such as it was, to be able to get Giannis. And again, was it four quarters for a dollar in the superstar trade that they ended up making? So that's the thing where anybody that really considered to be Miami a serious player in this, I think, wasn't really paying attention to the X's and O's side of it.
Right. And I think, again, I think Miami and Pat Riley made the right decision here in terms of they've topped out with that lineup after going on three or four consecutive playoff runs. And again, they're going to run into similar issues that Philly has. Philly, a handful of those guys have already been in the back half of the rotation, so it's not as good. Miami still has talent on the back end. You still have Pelle Larsson. You have Jokic. You still have some good, solid young pieces. The real question for them is, we all know, in comparison to the situation LeBron's going into, Giannis is going more into a situation very similar to what he initially had in Milwaukee, where you have guys like Wiggins, you have guys like Bam, you have guys like Davion Mitchell, who are all quality NBA players, but you're still kind of missing another sort of scorer off the bench or another starting guard to really help you. I think, and again, they're kind of hamstrung just due to the cap situation they're currently in right now, but after they get out of the season, they will have a runway of about 2 to 3 years where they will have optionality, where they will have the ability to go after guys. And we've seen this too, whenever you have a couple of super teams starting to grow in a conference, that a lot of guys, once we hit the buyout market, will really start to consider cash less important than trying to get a ring.
Absolutely. And you will see that there when they have the cap space. I agree with you on that. And again, they're at least a year out from having that happen. So the whole notion that they're automatically a playoff team in the East this year, I find to be absurd. I would say the same thing for Toronto, even if the Kawhi Leonard trade was still on at this point, and I think it probably will be at some point. My guess is that the league is going to exert some sort of punishment that won't keep them from making the deal. By the way, on the whole Kawhi deal with the Clippers and what they'd had previously and the circumvention of the cap and all that kind of stuff, it just goes to show you what an amateur level they were working on. You look at LeBron going to Philly, the business ties with Michael Rubin and Fanatics and everything like that, and nobody will ever prove anything. Like, you've got to be a real idiot to get caught in this league, Ben. I think that's the lesson of all of this. They never got caught on any alleged tampering from the Beijing Olympics in 2008 as far as LeBron going to Miami. There's a way to do things in the league here, and LeBron and the Clippers can only show up as being, I would say, Kawhi and the Clippers being rank amateurs as far as that, to even get caught in the first place, man. Come on.
Right, and I think this is going to be a really interesting situation for Toronto if he is able to go over in the trade in this timeline. Because, again, like we said, Philly, Cleveland, New York, Boston's in there too as probably the top four teams. But, again, we've used this rule, Rick. Toronto last year played Cleveland to a game seven relatively tough. And I would not be surprised with having a more consistent guy like a Kawhi Leonard over like a Brandon Ingram could push that team a little over the top. But again, this feels more like an intermediate move. That's what I would say. It's like, because Kawhi, despite his injuries, is still relatively younger at this time than Giannis and LeBron at this period. So it feels like to me that there is going to be an opportunity. And younger, I mean by, since he had those injury-plagued seasons, he has played less games over that period of time than guys like Giannis and LeBron. So,
right.
I think there's an opportunity for Toronto necessarily to start building here in year one and then start to push towards 2028, 2029 is when you want to be really competitive, because you're going to start to see some of these other teams in the East start to fall off a little bit.
Sure, but for a guy who's in his mid-30s and hasn't been very healthy for the last half decade, I mean, he held up pretty well, relatively speaking, this past year. But again, I'm really puzzled at the notion. I've seen so much of this. Well, Toronto was one of the teams that's definitely leapfrogged the Cavs. Like, to me, it was a thing more so with Detroit and Toronto of the Cavs playing with their food on those series going seven games. I think it was more so a negative on where the Cavs were at the moment in time as far as look at how close these teams are. I really didn't consider them to be that close. I'm sort of puzzled at the notion that Kawhi is going to elevate them that much. I mean, if Toronto grabs one of the six guaranteed spots, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, they've done it. They just did it last year. They could do it again.
As well too, I have more confidence in Toronto making the playoffs than Miami at this time. So just because we know they have more talent.
I probably do too, and I would say again when you're looking at the teams
and I'm not
in there.
I'm saying that Giannis and Miami can't make the playoffs. I'm just saying, that
right?
If you're looking at an apples to apples comparison in depth of talent, Toronto has more at this time.
And I'll be honest with you, there's another couple teams that I potentially put ahead of them. I think I put Atlanta ahead of both of them. I still have questions about Quinn Snyder, but going out and getting Lu Dort. And the situation here, you know, souping up the backcourt here as well and getting your long-term successor to C.J. McCollum in place and just everything that they continue to do. Atlanta is a team that I think I probably slot ahead.
I would make the argument, Rick, they are the most interesting team in the Eastern Conference right now.
They are. They're in part because of Quinn Snyder. I think they're a high-variance team. I think you don't necessarily know what to expect. I think the same to a degree in Orlando with Mosley getting blown out of there. Like, is Orlando going to start to be more than the sum of their parts rather than less than the sum as they seem to be over the course of the last year or so? Because you would think that a core of Banchero and Wagner and Bane would look better than what they had shown up to be. So that it's hard to assess them with a new coach on how much better that they're going to look. And I am just, color me like extremely, extremely puzzled that people are, and then some people might consider this to be a hot take, but where people are automatically penciling Boston in for a top six right now, minus Brown. I mean, if you're to tell me that George is going to hold up through the course of the season, right, then that's going to help. But the notion of like, you know, like we got rid of him so that, you know, Gonzalez could thrive and Pritchard and whatever, like historically in the league, you don't get rid of franchise player caliber guys so that this guy who's in our rotation can take some steps up.
Right.
That's not generally the way it works, Ben.
I think also the weird situation that Boston's kind of running into is that it's a massive fan base, arguably one of the most, you know, notable in the league outside of the Lakers. And it feels like to me that some of this is getting propped up by Boston fans who still believe that this is a very heavily competitive team. I think logically, if Paul George can have a great year, they are still in within the top four. And I think I wouldn't want to say pencil them in, but I feel like they're going to be a top six seed no matter what. But I would make the argument as well is that Tatum last season looked like he's still showing signs of having, he still needs to come back to full strength. We'll see how he plays in the first half of the season next year. It just kind of feels more like they took a step back, but then it's being propped up by a fandom that loves the team and on top of that does like to spend money on these websites that allow you to put money on things. So it does not surprise me that Boston will be a perceived favorite as long as again. And again, this could be the true irony of the situation. Last year, we had no expectations for them. And now, for some reason, people are giving them expectations. So it may be the inverse effect. We don't know. It's too early.
Yeah, I would agree with that, that you're taking Brown out of the mix of what was there a year ago. When we were looking at this like, oh, it's going to be a gap year without Tatum. They get Tatum back, but they lose Brown. They get George again for whatever that's going to be. And he does play into the outside shooting, ironically, better than Brown did. And there's a lot of analytic excess, I would say, of like, well, actually, they're a better team without Brown based on the last couple of years, which is crap because he had an MVP caliber season helping to carry the team in Tatum's absence last year. So you can just forget all of the stuff about, you know, a better team without him. No, that is not the case. There's no Ewing theory here as relates to him and the Celtics. And that's where, again, I think it's close to me, I think it's close to 50-50 on whether they're a top six team at this point. I think there's a lot that has to be proven. I think the playoffs kind of showed, you and I talked about this, I think somewhat off air, that series against Philly, that really during the season, I mean, they lived and died by the threes. They rarely died by the threes, always lived by them. And it kind of evened out a little bit in the postseason. And much like with Detroit, another big surprise team from last year that I would argue that them going out in the second round of the playoffs, I actually think even though they were the one seed and they won 60-plus games, I think they punched above their weight taking Cleveland to seven games. I think that was another thing where the Cavs played with their food. You and I talked about it all year that this is a team that is not as good as its record because who's their legitimate number two threat? And for as much as people are piling on Durin that, oh, he choked in the playoffs, he did not choke. He got exposed. You have to be able to have some floor spacing in there. Detroit never has had it consistently in this era here. And that's where, again, having everything go horribly kaput with Ivy has really hurt them. So you bring in John Collins, who's going to help with that a little bit. But, I mean, it might be much the same as like when Harris was there previously and he would help during the games that he was on. Is it going to be kind of the same thing with Collins, or is he going to be a little bit more consistent? So there's teams that people are automatically penciling in to come back right at where they were last year that I'm not, because I think they're closer to that bubble at the 6-7 line. Detroit is another one of them, I think, along with Boston.
Right, and I'd say Detroit has had a very quiet offseason.
Yeah.
They didn't make a lot of moves. It feels like they may be preparing for the future as well a little bit, maybe just figuring out, like, this is the best we could do. And, I mean, let's be totally honest, Rick. Detroit had a fantastic season. We're not debating that one bit. But in the playoffs, they were an average basketball team. They nearly lost to the Orlando Magic and essentially right. only won that series because Wagner got injured for the last two games.
That's so right.
They're a team that, again, they're young. They'll probably have a great opportunity to bounce back in this season to try and have a little bit more. Kay will have a little bit more seasoning under his belt. He'll have an ability now to maybe spread the floor more, try to focus more on the shots, because there was time during the Orlando series and the Cleveland series where it felt like the Cade Cunningham show and pretty much no one else did anything for most of those games. So.
Right. Yeah, that's what makes it tough. And, you know, you get into the other teams in the conference that have a chance to be a threat. Certainly, you look at Indiana returning back with Halliburton. They had the kind of gap year that we thought Boston was going to have. Or maybe we didn't think it was going to be as bad with Boston, but it ended up being pretty bad for Indiana. They end up missing the fifth pick in the draft because of the way that everything went with the trade with the Clippers. So they ended up missing out on the chance to get Keaton Wagler. But they return with a pretty full slate of guys on their roster. And then you've got the young teams in the East like Washington and Chicago and the teams that really kind of boned up in the draft here with DeBanza and Wilson, respectively. And so even the bottom part of the conference, particularly in this new post-tanking climate here, is going to be a lot more interesting now that there is an incentive if you're at the bottom to not be the most putrid team in the league. So that's where, again, you're going to be seeing, I think, the sub-20 win teams going by the wayside. And that's where, you know, maybe across the league, it may be tougher and tougher and tougher to win 60 games just because all those gimmies are going to be going away.
Right, and I feel like, too, was with the new draft lottery, you know, seeding, essentially, what's going to end up happening is you're going to see games later in the season that will be more competitive because, essentially, we saw there are points after Game 70 where some of the dregs of the league were essentially just giving games away or putting together lineups that would make a lot of people just blush in terms of how bad they were.
Yep.
But we're going to see, and I think also the East – just in terms of depth, it's going to be much more interesting. And another team we haven't even talked about yet is Charlotte. Even though they yep. trade away LaMelo Ball to Minnesota, they still have a very solid core group of guys with Kobe White, Brandon Miller, and Conk Neppel. So they're also a team that I'm not going to say it was better than last season, but they're a team that's now very interesting in terms of their youth and depth and getting Charles Lee another year of trying to work his offense that he brought over from Boston. So it's going to be a very interesting season for them as well.
I was going to ask what you thought about them next, actually, ironically. They get Hans Steinbeck in the draft. You end up getting a Naz Reid to play power forward in that ball deal. And I think the entire question of what this comes down to is that can you survive going from Ball to Coby White? Is the drop-off that's going to be there something that is going to retard the process of this young team as they continue to grow? Because, again, Knupel and, to a slightly lesser degree but almost the same, Brandon Miller having really, really, really superstar upside. You get Christian Anderson, who a lot of people, I think, consider to be a steal in the draft as your backup point guard right now. But that's where, again, you're not going to want to run him in there at this point. He's not going to be an answer to the situation at point guard. It's going to have to be Coby White, and or maybe you make another move at some point here. So how do you see that? Because that's another team that I see on the bubble of sort of 6 and 7 in the Eastern Conference, and that if they made it in over the teams that everybody's expecting to be in, like Boston and Detroit, I wouldn't bat an eyelid.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think anyone's really going to debate that LaMelo Ball has more talent than Coby White has. The big difference that LaMelo Ball has never been healthy.
Yeah.
So Coby White has, even though he's had his own injury problems as of late, he's played more games in the recent memory than LaMelo has. So it feels like, to me, at least, if we're looking at Charlotte, again, is it possible that you can move a guy who has superstar potential but you have a better fit and you allow guys like Knupel and Brandon Miller more time and more shot attempts? Mm-hmm. We'll see what ends up happening, because, again, we have to remember there's a period of time when Coby White, when he was healthy in Chicago, played really, really well. Looked like a guy who could be a consistent starter or potentially a low-grade all-star in the timeline. So they didn't give up much to get him. And I think maybe after a while, too, you get a little bit more financial flexibility. And, of course, you get Naz Reid, too, because, again, one of the issues they had last season, they did not have a lot of scoring from their post players. So
right,
that's going to fix that at least. And they'll have an opportunity because, yeah, like I said, with them, with Washington, with, you know, Atlanta, there's like a hodgepodge of teams right now that are in the bottom half of the Eastern Conference that I think are going to be much more competitive than people think.
I think so as well. I think the climate is going to be a lot different. When you look at the Western Conference, outside of the exodus of LeBron from the Lakers, the potential exodus, likely, I think, of Kawhi from the Clippers, I think a lot of the most interesting stories out there have had to do with the draft, with some of the players coming in and some of the longer-term issues here. Darren Peterson going to Utah. Again, all the top guys really looked the part in summer league. I think we can say that as kind of a blanket statement. But Peterson coming in to be the anchor that they build around in Utah. And you and I have talked about this. You know, you got George at point guard. And then the notion of, like, Peterson and Bailey at the swingman spots here, that is something that few teams in the league are going to be able to contend with. Would not shock me if this is the next team to take a rocket move up the standings the same way that OKC, San Antonio, and Houston have in recent years and kind of skip the middle part of contending. Also, Cameron Boozer in Memphis, but they're a longer-term kind of a deal. They moved Morant to Portland, so they're kind of admitting that is going to be a little bit of a rebuild there. But, you know, to me, a lot of the more interesting stuff in the Western Conference was of that slightly more long-term nature. And I think that kind of makes sense when you look at the landscape because of the perception that the East is relatively open versus the West. I think people are penciling in what we saw this past year, San Antonio, Golden State. There's a Freudian slip. San Antonio, Oklahoma City for the next 5 years for the Western Conference Finals, which I think would be premature. We've seen in the league that just when you start to count on one thing happening repeatedly for the long term, it turns out not to. Just the run of non-repeat champions that we've had over the last 8 years, that kind of backs it up as well. Although if Oklahoma City was to win the title this year, that would be perfectly in line with keeping that going, as they would not be a repeat champion. And they're probably my slight leader in the clubhouse, I would say, slightly over San Antonio and slightly over Philly at this point. But how do you see the West shaking out after an offseason that, to me, did very little to really kind of alter the upper part of the Western Conference? I suppose you could say LeBron to Minnesota, or LeBron. LaMelo to Minnesota would be the one thing that would, LeBron was rumored to Minnesota at one point, but yeah. Ball to Minnesota, that I suppose would be the one thing there. Of course, them giving up Reed, and then again, that being on the heels of them giving up Randall to the Nets, is like, I wonder if they knew they were going to make the second trade when they ended up making the first trade. But you know, that's talk about that in the Western Conference and on how anything has changed, if any, over the course of this offseason.
I mean, again, it feels like the most obvious things, the three top teams are still going to be San Antonio, OKC, and Denver. The Lakers, I don't know where to really place them right now. Obviously, having a healthy Luka and Austin Reeves will be helpful. I think they drop a little bit, but nothing too crazy. Obviously, I think Minnesota will probably take a step up if LaMelo can stay healthy and they can really spread the floor. Because that was one of the major issues that they've had over the last couple of years. They've essentially had to play a hodgepodge of point guards, from Conley to DiVincenzo to DeSumo. And I'm like, it's a hodgepodge scenario. Houston is probably the biggest question mark.
Yep.
They've probably, you would argue, a top 10 starting lineup in the NBA. I think that's not out of the realm of possibility for them, with a healthy Fred VanVleet on that team.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very interesting to see how their season starts to go. Golden State is kind of stuck in neutral. The Clippers are kind of stuck in neutral. The Suns, interesting, but we don't know what's going to happen with them. And then pretty much everybody else, Portland's probably going to stay within that playoff chase just with getting Morant and Lillard back healthy, just because we're seeing, like, in comparison to the East, there is a hierarchy in the Western Conference. And again, one of the big things I think we're going to start to see is that a lot of these younger guards that Wagner went to the Clippers, Acuff went to Sacramento, and then you're also going to see it'll be year two of Cooper Flagg in Dallas, and they have a very interesting roster right now too. So I would not be surprised if they get to the play-in tournament, based off of just what we've seen. And again, there are also teams that kind of stood pat in the offseason, like the Pelicans, and, you know, you could even make an argument that Sacramento didn't really make any major moves outside the draft. So it's, excuse me, a very, I don't want to say top heavy West, because it still feels like there's like six or seven decent teams out there outside of like the top two. It's just, it feels more like we just, I feel like it's more, well, what's the best word to say? It feels like we have a more easily visualized Eastern Conference. Like, we kind of know where the top teams are.
Yes.
And in the West, I mean, excuse me, for the playoff teams. And then in the West, we have the top three, and we will throw in probably a Houston or a Minnesota. But after that, we really just do not know who the rest of these seeds are going to be.
Well, and for as much as, and I agree with you, by the way, when you said about Houston being a team where there's a decent variance on where they may end up finishing this season, I think the poor man's version of that right now is the Clippers. And that has nothing to do with the Kawhi trade. I'm sort of assuming that that's going to happen in some form or fashion. But even what they're left with, so you have Garland, you have Wagner there, and that's a thing where it's indicative of building around a young core. But they have managed, again, Ty Lue being one of the best coaches in the league. I mean, they've had a relatively high floor the last couple of years. If they were to grab one of the top six playoff seeds there, I think it would require a better job of coaching out of Ty Lue even than he's done the last couple of years, to not have either Leonard or Paul George in the mix. But they're a team that's in transition right now.
Right.
But that's a thing where I still see the floor as being relatively high. I think there is zero chance they don't even make the play-in. And I think there's a 1-3 chance, even in a stacked Western Conference, that they grab a top six spot in a way that might look kind of inexplicable. So they're a very interesting team as well. And it's a thing where, you know, with Ballmer, you know, with the relatively new $2 billion arena, that, like, they're not looking to go on any kind of prolonged rebuilding project. So a lot of times that kind of gets in the way of what's best for the team. A lot of times you're best off swallowing, take a knee for a year or two, or maybe even three. That is not what the Clippers are going to do. And seeing the degree to which they can pull that off and be an actual playoff team as opposed to a play-in team is going to be one of the more interesting kind of under the radar stories, I think, of this season.
Right, and I think one of the big things that we'll see now, and especially in the NBA, it's not as bad as it used to be in terms of just trying to gain overall talent eventually, like, because the draft pool is as deep as ever right now.
Yeah.
And I feel like when we focus on stuff like that, there's an opportunity for even the Clippers or some of these teams that are at the tail end with, like, Sacramento. There's a legitimate opportunity for these teams, and in Memphis as well, to bounce back into the play-in, to bounce back into the playoffs relatively quickly, because the league is just so deep in terms of talent. It's not the same as the 80s and 90s where you had a handful of teams with a handful of talent. Now it feels like everyone from 1 to 30 has at least a top 50, top 100 guy.
Yeah, and I would say also, too, something you and I have talked about in the past, late 90s, early 2000s, especially in retrospect, a very, very, very thin time for the league because they'd gone through that radical amount of expansion and the talent pool hadn't caught up. And this time the talent pool has caught up. You factor in overseas, which was only a sporadic thing at best previously, maybe a Tony Kukoc here and there, maybe Sabonis when he comes over at the end of his career. But then really with Dirk in 99, you started to see in the 21st century to where that has really kind of caught up, and you have the international influx that's come in. And you and I have talked about this in recent years, really going back to 2020 on this show, a lot of times bemusedly about the league, like, now starting to embrace player development, as though that's not something they should have been doing for decades and decades and decades. But you see how this happens here. Going back to the early 2000s, you would see it with the San Antonio system there. Anybody that was under Coach Pop, you would see a little bit of that in terms of the Cavs at the time hiring Mike Brown to be coach, Danny Ferry to be GM. So you've seen a bit of this as it's gone on. You now see, and there's about five or six or seven teams in the league that have really been good at building systems, developing players, whatever. The Cavs now standing as a team where they're getting plucked. You've got Jordan Ott that went to Phoenix a year ago, and look at the job that he did of coaching up the talent that was there. Mike Gansey goes to Philadelphia, enough said. So that's a thing where, and going back to what we talked about before with the rotation that Philly has, and that, you know, thickening out that rotation, so to speak. As Gansey brings in some of the principles that they use to develop players in Cleveland, who was Sam Merrill before he got here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Philly may have some of the same amount of success now that Gansey is there. So it's interesting that you're seeing this sort of proliferation around the league. And it's not that it hadn't happened previously. You and I have talked about Jordy Fernandez the past couple of years, I think even before he was a head coach, but he goes to Brooklyn and you start to see it there. So in the Western Conference, that's what's going to be very interesting, is seeing how the young guys come along. Portland taking a big risk by letting Splitter go and kind of cheaping out after he did that tremendous job for them last year. So you wonder, as it goes here, you look at Summer League, Young Hansen coming in and, playing pretty well here. So I don't know if that means that he's going to get any kind of a sniff this year, unlike a year ago. But, that's a very interesting player development story.
Yeah, and outside of him, too, we're going to start to see a lot of these younger guys, like Jalen Slauson in Indiana is definitely a very interesting player. He played really relatively well in the summer league. You saw Young Hansen kind of develop and grow, and there's still a handful of other guys that were playing in summer league that are still there trying to get that next step. And we saw, too, with guys like Malik Thomas and some of the younger rookies who kind of fell late. Also the I'm blanking on let me see, I'm just trying to think off the top
which team.
Oh, for Dallas, their rookie guard,
okay, it's
Sergio De La Rea. He
oh yeah,
25, he had a pretty impressive summer league as well.
Yeah,
and we also got to see like some of the more high profile names, guys like Cameron Carr with the Lakers and Yoxel Londonborg, who looked very well early on in Golden State, the California Classic Summer League. And kind of, even though they don't get LeBron, he's going to be an impact player for them, because the one thing that they desperately needed last season was an athletic big who can hit an outside jumper, and that's exactly what he can do.
Yes, and Londonborg going to a team that, again, I mean, when Golden State looks in the mirror, they still see a contender, but that's, so I guess that's all that matters as far as what their intentions are. But for a team that sees itself as being a strong contender to be willing to play Lundberg in there, it's interesting because one of the things that I think is going to have some degree of replication around the league is, again, necessity is the mother of invention. Excuse me. We didn't expect San Antonio a year ago to go to the finals. I think, you know, you and I thought they could make a pretty good run, but they go to the finals and they have no choice but to do it playing Castle and Harper in heavy minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that has, it's a lesson that has taken root around the league here. And I'm certainly not saying that it's going to be a trend. It will not be a trend that, like, let's just lean on this rookie for all this kind of stuff. But even before, even when there was the chance of LeBron coming to the Cavs, I still thought that there was a really good pathway to Malik Thomas carving out a role in the rotation this year, and maybe even a quasi-decent one, as far as being a guy who could play at either spot in the backcourt, can come in, can be that microwave guy off the bench, and a guy who only dropped to 34 because apparently the market inefficiency of a lot of teams going, well, it's hard to gauge him playing next to Darius Acuff, you know, as though you weren't able to gain lessons from the combine, as though you didn't have film without him playing with Acuff in high school, et cetera, et cetera. But be that as it may, I think that you're going to see guys like Lundberg and Thomas on teams that have aspirations of going far, really going in and playing more of a role than perhaps they might have in the past, because San Antonio, I think, showed this past year that if it's a player with the right amount of maturity and development that's there, that you can just sort of, you know, close your eyes, let go, and let them play.
Right, and I think that's going to be something that we see from a lot of these top rookies and some of the, you know, lesser names that summer league who, you know, like the big impacts of guys like Mikal Brown Jr. in Brooklyn. You're also going to see Allen Graves in Toronto. I mean, obviously, probably the biggest and most interesting player that come out of summer league, obviously, Caleb Wilson of Chicago, went from a guy that not a lot of us had high expectations for, and now we're starting to see that he has that ability. And despite the Bulls' track record in drafting small forwards and athletic big guys, he looks like a guy that could definitely take the next step and help grow that franchise where they've been in the doldrums for a while, Rick. They've been in essentially NBA purgatory forever. But getting him, having Bouzelis, and having the opportunity to grow that sort of unit from within is going to be very interesting to see. And again, too, like teams like Chicago and Brooklyn are probably going to be at the lower half of the Eastern Conference. Mm-hmm. But these are not bad teams. These guys have a lot of talent on these rosters.
No, they're not. And that's where, you know, you talk about some of these teams here that somebody like the aforementioned Utah Jazz, when I talked about what this season might look like for them, and the fact that, again, while I'm sure they'd rather have Kessler coming back to play center, it at least gives them the clarity of direction here. You move Triple J to center, you play Markkanen just at the four there, that opens up the three decidedly for Bailey to be able to play in that spot, and then you got the backcourt of George and Peterson. That is a really good starting five. I would even say, as much of a mouthful as it is, probably one of the better starting fives in the league on day one. Not that you won't have your ups and downs, but a team where they're going to really be slingshotted, I think. Again, I think towards the front of the Western Conference, not merely by adding Peterson, but again, this whole thing of like they were artificially bad a year ago as far as, you know, the combinations that were put together, the targeted benchings of guys to boost their draft stock, and it worked. You ain't cheating if you ain't trying. So it's one of those things where there's going to be a lot of commentary in the first 2 months of the season in particular, like, where did they come from? And it's just like, man, you weren't paying attention. This is a team where their record was in no way indicative of what they had last year. You add Peterson to the mix, and that's just a turbocharge to what they already had. So, and ironically, for as badly as they wanted to Bansa, and I get it, and all the ties, you know, to Ainge in the front office and state of Utah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you could look at it and say, just if you're looking at the fit of the roster, Peterson coming in to play shooting guard is maybe a better fit right there. So they're a team where, again, this – this looks like it could be, in the next 2 or 3 years, maybe the best version of the Utah Jazz in the history of the franchise. And I get what a mouthful that is when you go back to the 80s and the 90s, but this is definitely a team that has a chance to be the best version of the franchise they've ever had.
Yeah, and again, like we said, that as much as Jazz fans wanted the Vance and the local community wanted the Vance because it went to BYU, Peterson is arguably, like you said, the better fit. And despite what people think about Utah last year, they were relatively decent at home, and they did beat some good teams overall. This was not a team that won, like, only 10 games all season. It just looked awful. Like, they, you know, it was one of those scenarios where the upper management was much more focused on trying to figure out how to improve their draft stock and to get a top three player, which is something that Utah has not really had in most of their existence as a franchise. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they grow. And they still got a handful of other pieces that we haven't really talked about yet. I know we'll talk about them more during the regular season, but this is not a bench that is completely devoid of talent either.
It's not, yeah. And that's the thing where I think I've got them penciled in over as a sixth seed or better in the Western Conference over some teams that some other people might be looking at and considering to be ahead of them in the pecking order. Like I said, I know that Golden State still looks in the mirror and sees a serious contender, but I think if they were, then you might have seen LeBron going there for the chance for him to play with Curry and then also to play underneath Steve Kerr. But again, you don't know when you're going to get Jimmy Butler back. You don't know what he's going to look like at this stage of his career coming off of this injury, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I think the twilight essentially continues for that franchise, I must say. On an editorial note, I say that not at all regretfully. But, there's a lot of really, really interesting stories there. You talked about New Orleans standing pat previously, and they're just going to continue to do so, I guess. Like that – that roster there reminds me of, and quite frankly, with this modern version of Sacramento, I guess reminds me of what we used to say about Sacramento, that, you know, like what a mess it was. But like in New Orleans, you just look at that roster and you can't make heads or tails out of what they're trying to do. And again, they're going to go for the kind of grow from within kind of, you know, thing here. That like
again, another, they're not lacking talent either, Rick. It's just a lot of hodgepodge.
But how does it fit? Yeah. How does it fit? And that's where, and I will say this, that, I mean, unless they kind of dodged the bullet perceptually, although unless, and there is the chance here. I think there is the chance because a lot in what we said previously was a very historic point guard draft. Unless Kingston Fleming's proves to be one of the best players in the NBA, which, you know, I think is at least somewhat possible/plausible, then they kind of dodged a bullet on the perceptions of the Derek Queen trade. The fact that they didn't put the draft perception on it, Atlanta falling to ninth in the draft. So it could have been a lot worse. I mean, had Atlanta gotten to Banza or Peterson or any of those guys, it would have been all over. Has Joe Dumars learned his lesson on protecting draft picks? Highly unlikely. So, yeah, what they continue to do, and that's the thing where, again, and I'm expecting that there's going to be a lot of tears shed for potentially them or Memphis or whatever. Like, this is why the new system isn't fair. These teams don't have a chance to contend here. But as I've been saying all along, ever since they tweaked the rules, being one of the worst teams in the league is and has been a matter of choice. You can go out there and you can get players that can raise your floor. Guys who can really raise your ceiling are very rare. Guys who can raise your floor, you can go get them if you want to. New Orleans hasn't chosen to. Memphis is communicating that they're at the beginning of a rebuild. So whatever happens is essentially what they've brought upon themselves for this season.
Right, and we're going to see after year one of this, how everything starts to shake out. Because again, we'll use this rule too, that the original draft lottery wasn't perfect either. And we've seen it go through many machinations. And we've even seen this now where, look, like out of the last 8 lotteries, like a lot of the bad teams didn't get the top pick. So what ends up happening is like, we could see a hodgepodging change of that. And again, right now, we don't know how everything will shake out. I know this is just a temporary fix. We could see some changes to it later. But it feels like we're going to at least see a much more balanced NBA schedule in comparison to what we've seen in years past, where if you get eliminated by game 60, you're essentially packing it in for next season.
Yeah. And taking away that incentive, as I think that they've done relatively firmly here, I think is going to pay dividends in terms of the competitive balance of the league, especially in, like you said, the last 2 months of the season or so. So with what has been a very active and interesting offseason here, any additional thoughts you have that we didn't get to yet?
I think the real question now is mainly going to be on the guys who are not signed. And we're going to start to see the real questions going to be just when the start of the preseason and seeing if any of these younger players can start to break out. And again, we may see a guy in Philadelphia, in Thylon, who had a very good summer league, who is just in a weird situation, now having an opportunity to come off the bench and maybe that next great guard in the NBA.
That's a great point, because when we talk about this, that Philly's bench being a little bit kind of thin at the moment here, that was already a guy where, again, Philly was looking at this, you know, Ganzi and the crew that he has assembled here as far as, you know, developing him a little bit more, getting him a little bit more polished up. But that's a guy that you have to assume is probably going to be in the rotation, even in a win now situation with this team here. The fact that his ceiling is higher, even as a rookie, than a lot of the other schlemiels that they're looking at to potentially fill out a rotation here, that's where maybe the San Antonio precedent comes in, of where a young guy gets thrown, not into the deep end quite like in San Antonio. That's very, very rare. That's maybe once in a generation that you see something like that. But a guy who's a rookie, who gets thrown into something quicker than you might normally think in a win now situation, simply because, again, his ceiling just kind of trumps a lot of the other guys there, and that Philly is going to have to gamble on the talent level with some of these guys.
Yeah. And I think the real question is, they're not the only team we're going to see it in Cleveland. We're going to see it in New York. We're going to see it with the Lakers. We're going to see it in Boston. So it's going to be an interesting preseason start to the season, where I think we're going to see a lot of coaches start to focus on their rotations a little bit earlier than usual, because there's just so many question marks with so many teams in terms of their first 8 or 10 guys on the floor.
Yeah, we talked about it before in passing with Malik Thomas with the Cavs with the summer league that he had, and you mentioned the Knicks. And in particular, there's a guy that a lot of people are looking at, and that this may be a classic example of, you look back of like, how did he fall out of the first round in terms of, again, you have teams drafting for, you know, the ceiling rather than for the floor. But Bruce Thornton from Ohio State looks to be the kind of guy who can be a very serviceable player coming in for them, potentially a fan favorite in New York for all the different ways that he can impact a game. I've been hearing nothing but good things about him as far as what the fit might be in the system in New York.
Right. And it feels like, to just in general, in terms of how the Knicks are going to build on their championship team. And they did lose a couple of things, but they also gained some guys. And Andre Drummond, I think, is going to be a good fit off the bench, can stretch the floor a little bit now. So the one thing, advantage that they have, Rick, is they are still 5 deep. They still have a good bench, and they've had another year to just keep perfecting their existing system.
Well, and that's it. And that it's a system that really kind of came together on the fly down the stretch. And again, all credit to Mike Brown for designing that and for getting the team to, you know, a juggernaut level in the postseason. What's going to be really, really, really interesting here is, again, because there's two ways to look at that, and I think it's equally valid. The one way is you have unlocked the best version of Cat, and that he can basically play facilitator as well as everything that he can do offensively, and that what he can do as a secondary or perhaps even primary playmaker in that offense helps take them to another level. Also, it's a thing where wasn't really any film on it when they rolled it out. This was just like, we're going to try this. So I'm always fascinated. I usually think of it more so in the NFL with the offseason of like, okay, you know, everybody's sitting there watching, the coordinators are watching film all summer. What's this going to look like? So this is not like, I'm not comparing this to, you know, the Wildcat or the pistol offense or anything like that in football, but there's going to be an attempt to counter what the Knicks are doing here. Right. And I can't tell you that I have any idea what it is. but it's coming and it's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And we're going to start to see, obviously, I would not be shocked to see teams like San Antonio, teams like Philly, teams like OKC try and use that hub mentality. And we saw it a little bit last year with OKC using Hartenstein essentially at the top of the key and getting the ball to like Cason Wallace and Shea. So we'll see if a lot of, again, the league is a copycat league. We've discussed this before. It would not shock me to see a lot more playmaking bigs trying to isolate at the top of the key to try and get their teammates more opportunities to get better baskets.
Yes, and that's a thing where, again, you know, that I don't know how much of it was necessarily from the top of the key back in the day, as the film was a lot sparser in the day of Wilt Chamberlain, but that was a guy who obviously had a boatload of assists as well as points. But in the modern era, it really is Jokic that kind of unlocked it for the rest of the league. And you've seen, to a certain degree, some of the imitators here. You've seen Sabonis, you've seen Bam Adebayo, you've seen some guys have been able to do this, and now Cat with the manifestation of how he's being used here. Hartenstein, I find to be very interesting, because you look at it, and again, in doing my draft forecast for the last 2 years, I was factoring in that, like, okay, clearly Oklahoma City is going to try and load up on big men, because that's, they've been paying $29 million a year to Hartenstein, and that can't go on indefinitely. Well, they ended up signing him to a mild discount on an extension. So they decided they prioritized keeping him. Unsurprisingly, that means that Lu Dort goes by the wayside here. But, you know, you've got for a team that's going to have A.J. Mitchell coming back in after his breakout year last year, Jalen Williams presumably coming back in healthy. One of the biggest questions in the league is going to be, where's Chet Holmgren's head at after that disastrous playoff series against San Antonio culminating in game 7. But this is still a team that I see as the slight favorite overall, and a team that I think can bounce back. They were not fully healthy, of course, against San Antonio in the Western Conference Finals. San Antonio is also poised potentially to take another step forward and win it all this year. So yeah, that's that rivalry between those two teams right there. That is the defining nexus of the league, I think, heading into this season, just as it was the last season.
Right, and I think, again, there's going to be more competition for those final spots more than ever now. I think we went from 2 years of very top-heavy to now where there's a legitimate chance that 8 or 10 teams could make the finals this year.
Yes, I think so. And, again, it's going to be, you know, just the fact that we've had teams that have sort of perceptually at least kind of come from nowhere the last couple of years to at least make the finals. I mean, you go back to Miami in 23, Dallas in 24. I would say certainly Indiana in 25. And I'm not exactly, again, the Knicks this year, you could say yes or no, that people had them sort of in that tier of teams that could do it. But a lot of people had them slotted at the very least behind Boston coming into the playoffs. So it really is a scenario where, and again, it does seem, even with Philly doing what they did, it seems like the whole all things are possible, slightly more so in the Eastern Conference than in the Western Conference, because Philly, again, having to answer the questions they're still going to answer, they don't have a stranglehold on the East the way that perceptually, collectively, OKC and San Antonio do on the West, I think.
Right, and I tend to agree with that. And it's going to be a really interesting season. And I feel like there's still a lot of stuff we do not know. And we're going to have to see how Philly meshes, how New York meshes with their new bench, and if San Antonio and OKC can keep pace in the Western Conference.
Yeah. So going to be a lot to look forward to. And I think a strong period of time for the league as far as the exciting stars that the league has to offer. Again, just another influx, a strong influx with another excellent draft, even better than the 25 draft, which brought us Cooper, Flagg, and Con Knupple. You got a draft that went, we knew, at least 4 deep at the top this year, and then what I think is going to prove to be a historic run of point guards that followed from there. And then the other guys in the mix as well, who seem like they are prepared to kind of, you know, outpunch where they went, whether it be Bruce Thornton as sort of an all-star role player kind of a guy, if you will. I know it's a contradictory term, but somebody that's an elite role player. Wouldn't surprise me if he was that for the Knicks. Malik Thomas for the Cavs, who I think is going to way outperform the 34th draft slot, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Carr for the Lakers, he's certainly going to be getting a lot of opportunities now. Because they're in a process of starting over, whether they want to admit it or not. So, yeah, so much to be able to look forward to. I look forward to catching up with you again, basketball-wise, at the start of the season. And hint, 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 I will be talking with you on the show in the very near future on non-basketball matters. But always a pleasure to talk hoops or anything else with you, my man. Thank you so much for being here today. The great Ben Chu, FDH Hoops Analyst. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Rick. Oh, I did. Since we're at the tail end of the show, I do need to correct an error. You said Bruce Thorne was with the New York Knicks. He's actually on Houston's roster.
My bad. He moved to Houston. Okay.
I figured it's just like part of the interruption. I got it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That is.
I was very excited there for the Knicks first. I'm like, man, Bruce Thorne had a great summer league.
I misread Wikipedia. I'm relieved, actually.
That was one of the struggles they had last season. They did not have a good backup guard outside of Lee Shepard. So Thorin is going to be a very interesting player for them as well.
Yeah, I'm relieved that he's not in the Eastern Conference. And Shepard, again, yeah, my guy there, a guy that, you know that I'm going to love a player whose comp by a lot of people is Mark Price, one of my all-time favorite players of all time. So certainly I'm rooting for that guy. And I must say, by the way, for anybody that wants to go check it out on YouTube, that we are living in the golden era of, I won't say historical revisionism, but historical discovery of Mark Price, the greatest thing that never got to be at his true potential level. Like, had he been healthy, had he played in today's game, whatever, like the stuff that's out there, Isaiah Thomas in particular doing a great video about him, the greatness of Mark Price. So seeing him get discovered and appreciated by another generation, certainly going to warm the cockles of my heart. So, yes. But, Bruce Thornton, glad to have him out of the Eastern Conference here. And, yes, a boon to Houston as far as I could blame this and say the way that it was formatted on Wikipedia for the draft page was a little misleading. But I will own up on that one. So. But anyways, that's always great to do our coverage, warts and all, which we will always own up to. So, but never any warts in having you on the show, warts of any kind, Ben Chu, never any of them having you on. Thank you so much, buddy. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1939.